session number 23221, reel 8.
Major Mole, reel 8. You were saying that you were quite a long way back from the area of operations in your company base.
Well, there weren't really any areas of operations per se. I mean, we were there to stop the Indonesians coming across and disturbing the peace, as it were. And because the 3rd Division was so vast, there wasn't much indication at that stage of Indonesian incursions, although there was the odd one. And so basically we were initially patrolling, putting out the odd posts on the river, and winning the hearts and minds, as it were, of the people in the more distant longhouses to keep us informed, using as well, of course, the Ardaic people.
What were they for, the 50 Dayak?
Well, they weren't there all the time. It was somebody's idea at some stage, I can't remember when they were brought. The idea was that the Dayaks were meant to be such amazing trackers, and it was their jungle, they knew exactly where they were. But when we did use them on one occasion, which I'll describe a little bit, I think the Dayaks were not exactly the most, I didn't quite use the word brave, but I don't think if they were likely to meet anybody, they would be very far forward. They were a little bit inclined to be moving backwards. And I think a lot of the Dayak business, when you met, sort of came across skulls in the longhouses and things, I think there was a pretty skulking sort of business when you went through the jungle and you came across somebody and you used your blowpipe in the old days. I should think it was all a pretty nasty sort of hole in the back sort of operation. I don't think they were extraordinarily brave individuals. But still, that's just...
When you sent patrols out, what strength would they be normally?
I think the patrols were basically platoon patrols, almost always. You'd go to somewhere, and we used boats a lot to get up, and helicopters and things.
How far would they go? And
the helicopter patrols would go really, I mean, considerable distance. I mean, you know, I can't remember the distance involved, but I mean, you'd be 30, 40 miles in, because it's a very, very big area. And you'd, they would stay in there for some time, patrol around, see if there was any sign of. But I'll give you an example of one action. We got some information late one evening that there was some bandits had come. Some Indonesians had come into a longhouse down the river from us at a place called Song, and then down a river off that called the Angkwa River, and the headman of the of one of the longhouses down the Angkwa River had come in late at night into a missionary center in Song, and said that there was a large group of Indonesians there. So we were stood to and got to this place at Song, and it was quite a dramatic business. I can remember that we had the whole company and plus the headman and various people, and we set off in about 10 boats down the Angkwa River to this longhouse, it was really quite impressive, because some chap, one of the Indonesians, no, one of the locals, had produced a Union Jack and tied it to one of the boats. And there we were going down with the Union Jack, and I felt like something out of Boyzone expedition going
Saunders of
the River. Anyway, we got down to this longhouse, and the headman told us where he thought the group was, and the group was reputed to be about 30 or 40 strong. And they were somewhere south of the longhouse and up to the east. So we set off in pursuit with the guides and things, and we followed them up for about 2 days. And you could see the tracks and things. And eventually we did make contact, and I think we killed about six or eight bandits. One of our chap was wounded. It was basically the platoon's. It wasn't a brilliantly planned attack or anything, because it wasn't as if they were in a camp or anything.
Were they on the move when you called them?
They were on the move.
So you bumped into their rear element?
The leading platoon, which was patrolling on a fairly wide basis, saw some bandits and engaged them, and then got around behind. And it was, like all these things, it was a pretty confused sort of action. But anyway,
how far could you see then through that sort of jungle?
Well, you couldn't see, really. You can't see it hardly at all. I mean, just, you know, unless you were looking across a ravine or something. Mm. Probably 20, 30, sometimes 100 yards, depending on how clear the jungle was at that. And we had one young man wounded, and I remember in these operations, it's quite difficult to know what the company commander should be doing, because, I mean, you have these excellent young Gurkha officers, etc., who are commanding their platoons, and in a sense you didn't feel you wanted to be taking their position, and yet, you know, you had to be seen to be around. But anyway, I remember taking this young wounded chap back down a boat a little way to a helicopter, where we get a helicopter in and sending him out. So it was a good little operation, and everybody seemed very pleased. And one of my young officers got an MC in that. The MCs came quite lightly at that stage in the operation, but he was very involved in the fighting. And the RAF chap who came in the dark, actually in the last light to lift out this wounded Gurkha, subsequently was given the MBE. So it was quite. And then later the next day, Walter Walker came in with the CO, because Walter Walker was very much hands on, and it had been quite a successful contact. And one of the sort of first successes we'd had in that region for some time. So he came in and had a chat and flew out again.
Do you remember what he said?
No, I can't remember what he said very much. No, I think he said, "Well done, Mole," or something like that. But
when you said that your first platoon was going forward fairly wide, what sort of frontage would they be on for a patrol going forward?
They wouldn't really be on a frontage. I think it would basically be the platoon would really be advancing as not quite single file, but there'd be a leading section, yes. Leading scout, leading section. The other sections would be behind. It wasn't really spread out in that sense. Mm. And another platoon would be on the other, a bit further over.
Did you have a Dyak tracker to direct you on that?
We had some Dyaks with us, but to be perfectly honest, they weren't all that brilliant, and the Gurkhas themselves are actually very good at tracking, so we didn't really count very much on them.
What sort of traces had the Indonesians left behind them on their movement through there?
Well, it's the same as anybody walking in the jungle, or staying in the jungle at any time. You do leave a trace, your footprints, and especially if near streams, you can't avoid making footprints in the wet, and breaking twigs and that sort of thing. It's relatively easy, if 20 or 30 people have walked through a thing, to see a track that somebody's walked along it.
What happened to the Indonesians that you shot up, the casualties?
Well, that was really rather unpleasant. The only ones, the six we'd killed or the eight we'd killed, I can't remember what they were, we had to take down river in a in one of these boats. I had to take them down again to a helicopter place where they were flown out because in case there was any information on them.
What sort of uniform were they wearing?
I think sort of, if I remember rightly, a sort of jungle green type. But I think on that particular occasion, went down in the boat with these bodies. I've one of the first times in my life was confronted by the unpleasantness of war, because these characters were splendid looking young men. The Indonesians are fine looking people, and there they were sprawled out, and I'm quite sure they had no idea why they were fighting us. Particularly they'd been sent in by Sukarno, and I just thought what a stupid situation it was, really. Here were Gurkhas from Nepal fighting Indonesians who didn't want to fight in Sarawak, probably. But I mean, when I say they didn't want to fight, they fought jolly bravely, but that's not the point. The point is that I was struck suddenly by the total stupidity of the whole thing.
What were their weapons like? Did you recover their...
I'll be perfectly honest, I can't remember. They were, you know, perfectly good infantry weapons. I can't remember, really.
And you'd inflicted about 6 to 8 casualties on them. You'd have one man wounded.
We had one man wounded. Mm-hmm.
Was that your major contact while you were in the...
Well, that was a major contact in that. And then no sooner had we gone back from that when there was the famous incident of Long Joey, which later became, I think, a battle honour. But D Company were much further up the river than we were. I think it was D Company, in a place called Belaga. And beyond Ford of Belaga, a long way forward, they had left some standing patrols in the longhouses, right, the very last longhouse on the river before Indonesia. And I personally was always dubious about this policy, because it struck me that to leave 3 or 4 riflemen in a longhouse or known to be where exactly they were was foolish, because it left them in a very dangerous position. And subsequently, that's exactly what happened. I when I was involved with my lot, I insisted that they stayed in the jungle nearby, but not unknown to the diets, to exactly where they were. But on this particular occasion, in the Belaga situation, or the Long Jai situation, it was called, the Indonesians attacked these 4 or 5 riflemen who were in effect in a defensive position, had a defensive position on the hill, and there was very serious fighting took place. And if I remember rightly, I can't remember the details, but at least 2 or 3 riflemen were killed, Gurkhas were killed, and the Indonesians were quite a serious force. And we were the closest company to this, so we were told at very short notice to fly in these helicopters and see what was going on. So we flew across the Hose Mountains. It was really rather dramatic, and landed at this place, Long Jai. And of course, when we arrived there, and I had the whole company, or did I? No, I had only one platoon was available. That's right, one platoon, and a slightly strong platoon. And there was no sign of anybody. The villagers had fled. There were no Gurkhas. There was nothing. So we had to wander around. We couldn't see anything very much, and we dug in and into positions that night. And we waited to see what was happening. And then we contacted, if I remember rightly, one of or two of the Gurkhas or villagers came back, and we found out roughly what had happened. And the Indonesians had moved up the river, across the other side of the river, and had taken a lot of the Dayak guides with them, and they subsequently found they shot most of those. And so we were in a slightly odd position, because the rivers at this time, the river was in full spate, absolutely immensely powerful, and it wasn't possible to cross the river. We hadn't got any boats, and it wasn't possible to cross the river at all. The CEO, this chap called Johnny Clements, was quite cross with me, because he said, come on, you've got to get across and follow these chaps up. It's clearly they're on the other side of the river. And we had put another platoon of mine called B, of B Company, forward, some 10 miles up the river, so that they could cut them off anyway. And he was quite indignant that I couldn't cross. And I said, well, you can come and have a look yourself, but it's totally impossible to get across.
Did he come and have a look?
No, he didn't, in fact. But the adjutant came up. And by this time, I had got one platoon forward and that platoon, etc. So I decided myself to go back to company base. And in due course, they managed to get this platoon across by helicopter and follow up that way. So it was... I was actually, because I had been in Singapore at that time, before that, and had been involved in this Ankara operation, and then come straight into this one, and I was in my late 38. I was pretty whacked, and so I actually needed a bit of a break. So that was really that instant, but in fact. Later on, about 2 days later, the bandits or the Indonesians were shot up going past the platoon, which was further up, and they shot and killed about 26 of them in the boat, in boats and things, and so. We didn't sort of more or less finish off. And that chap got an embassy as well, that Gurkha, who was sitting in ambush on the river.
So you got your forward platoon, and it did the job.
It did the job to get out there. But at that time, you see, a lot of it was being moved by... Because I'd been in the jungle with the thing, and I was felt, you know, I was just sitting as a platoon commander virtually, and I wasn't really controlling much, because I couldn't, because I was in there. That was one of the reasons I decided to come out. But it was the CO at that time was sort of moving platoons around, as it was quite right that he should, because, you know, there we were in a situation where you had to get what was available there.
I was going to ask you whether within your own area, which you've described as being a very large area, about the size of Wales, whether you were left to determine and generate your own patrol program and activity, or whether you were subject to...
Now, most of the time, one was totally get on to exactly what you wanted. But when, of course, situation of this one, because the situation was really quite serious with this major incursion, which resulted in the Long Jaya action.
What sort of strength was the Indonesian force? You said that 26 or so of them were shot.
Well, they said there were 26. I never was quite convinced that there were 26, but that was the figure that went down in the annals, as it were. I think they were... reputed to be about 60 or 70 strong. They were under quite well-known Indonesian major who was reputed to be a good commander. And they'd been quite serious in their incursion and done really quite a lot of damage. But I was really quite... cross of this policy of leaving isolated Gurkhas in positions which were well known to the villagers, because I thought it was asking for trouble, and subsequently it was proven to be right.
Did you think the villagers might have been leaky then?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
The Indonesians had their agents as well.
Well, the Indonesians, you have to think, of course, that that area of the people, the Dayaks at the top end of the river, were used to, in peacetime, crossing over into Indonesia, trading and walking up, although it was a considerable distance. But they obviously did go across, and you know, they didn't have this vast loyalty necessarily to us or to anybody else. They were probably had families on the other side or married across, etc. So it was only natural that that there should be a certain amount of leakiness going on. So really, that's the last of my strong memories, and then I think we went back after that to Hong Kong. And but it was considered quite a, I mean, it, my company, I was very proud of the company, because we'd really inflicted some quite heavy casualties. And
sounds like you had a great deal more success with contacts in Borneo than you'd had in
Malaya. Absolutely, because
that presumably because the enemy were more active.
Well, the enemy were acting as coming in as platoons and companies, as it were. But you know, the impression of giving you those two accounts, which are relatively interesting. Of course, most of the time nothing happened at all, and you were just patrolling. And it was actually very interesting, because it's a beautiful part, lovely countryside, and very interesting.
Were most of your patrols, again, were they directed by intelligence, or were they?
No,
they were.
No, not really. No, it was us trying to. I mean, I remember doing one patrol myself, which I thought would be quite interesting, with just four Dayaks and four Gurkhas, I think. We decided to just go over and have a look right into the, just, it was the start of the Claret operations, yeah. Although not seriously. And we went just slightly into Indonesia, just to where we didn't see any signs of anything, but it was just a sort of an endeavour to do a very small recce patrol, which was interesting.
Were there practicable, clear paths and tracks through the jungle, or were you really confined to the rivers for your main line of communication?
Really, hardly any signs of tracks at all. I suppose there were tracks between the odd longhouse, but basically all movement was in these wonderful longboats, which were really very interesting to travel in.
How many people could you get into at one of the boats that you were using?
I think you could get about eight men in a longboat. And of course, they were all driven by Dayaks, who understood how to get through the rapids and how to drive them, etc. And it was very beautiful. I mean, the rivers up there are very clear, and except when they're in full torrent, when they're terrifying.
Were the boats powered? Did they have
outboard motors? Those outboard motors with long the actual propeller is on a very long
long shaft
so that it's put out behind the boat, because of course the rivers are very shallow in parts, and so it works that way. But they were nice people on the whole, the Dayaks, and we got on well with them.
What were your communications like? Did you have good comms back to battalion headquarters?
Yes, communications work very satisfactorily. Radio.
And the helicopters, did the Wessex prove to be a reliable?
The Wessex were terrific. They were very, very good. And we had a very close association with the Wessex. And we had great admiration for them as pilots, etc. They weren't there all the time because they were required, but they were there most of the time. So we could use them quite extensively.
How did you find satisfactory landing zones for them? Did these occur naturally in the jungle?
Well, basically on river, yes. On river beds, you could usually land somewhere. There was lots of areas on the rivers where there would be a shingle bank or something. You could land on a shingle bank. But when they got into deep jungle, they had to clear LZs. And one of the problems was that to get in and out of an LZ, which is in primary jungle, at a height, because we were at some stage there, we were quite high up. It was really quite difficult because the helicopter had to, no, a helicopter likes to move slightly forward when it takes off rather than going directly up.
Yes.
But if it's going up directly, carrying a platoon of men or a certain number of men, its power of lift was smaller. And of course, it used a lot of fuel. I remember on one occasion we'd flown to give some rations to one of the platoons, which was well forward, and flying back with this pilot back to near Balaga, which was where we had some helicopters up there as well. I noticed that the pilot looked a little bit pale. And when we landed, he said, I didn't tell you, John, but we actually only had 2 minutes fuel left. Concorde. Sail home.
One more thing about the business in the jungle. Did you have any connection with the SAS who were operating in the area?
No, we didn't. The Gurkhas also had, under a chap called John Cross, they started something, a long-range sort of...
long-range recce.
Sort of thing, with Dyaks, but it didn't really take off. The SAS were around, but we didn't... I mean, I don't think the SAS were any better than the Gurkha platoons. The Gurkhas, by this time, were very experienced in jungle law and jungle warfare, not jungle warfare, but jungle law and movement, etc., and they were as good as anybody, as was proven in the claret operations, which you know about later on when companies went over and got involved.
How much did you know about those? You said you were there just at the beginning when they were starting them. Were you fully au fait with what was likely to go on?
No, I didn't. I wasn't really, because it was just... I can't remember how it was, but those claret operations in which lots of our younger company commanders were involved and did exceedingly well, must have been a little bit later than that.
Well, they were Walter Walker's brainchild.
Yes, absolutely, yeah.
You said you got in your little boat and you sailed away into the sunset.
Into the sunset. Yeah.
Did you find it difficult to adjust to civil life, having been in the army for so many years?
Well, I didn't quite get in my little boat from there. Mm-hmm. After that, the confrontation ended, etc., and we went back to Brunei, and I became second in command of the battalion, etc., and I left from there. With enormous regrets, in many respects, leaving the Gurkhas after all that time. The extraordinary thing is, I suppose, that one left with the golden bowler of some enormous sum of money, like £10,000, thinking the world was going to be at one's feet. And when I think of it now, leaving at 40 with two children and no job to go to, etc., how I thought it was, I was just assumed that I would, without the slightest difficulty, find a job and everything would be thing. And it did so luckily work out more or less, but when I think of it now, it makes me feel quite cold with horror.
But was it all right being a civilian, having been an officer for so long?
Yeah, I didn't find it too difficult to change. And whereas I think I might have told you, I started off in the whiskey business and I got an interesting job with an independent whiskey distiller called William Grant and Sons. And I enjoyed it. It was very interesting work. I did find selling rather difficult. Sort of slightly infidigging, having to actually sell something till I realized that that's what life was about. So, there we are.